This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Former President Trump is arraigned in federal court in Washington, D.C. on charges related to his alleged efforts to overturn his 2020 election defeat. CBS's Robert Costa.
Inside, Trump was fingerprinted. In the courtroom, he raised his right hand to be sworn in. He stated his name and gave his age as 77. He pleaded not guilty to four charges brought in a grand jury investigation being led by special counsel Jack Smith, who was also in the courtroom. Three counts of conspiracy, one for obstruction, for allegedly leading a criminal conspiracy to try to overthrow the 2020 presidential election. The judge told Trump the obstruction charge alone carries a maximum of 20 years in prison.
The former president, after his court appearance, calls this
a sad day for America.
Federal health officials give a thumbs up for a new vaccine to protect babies from severe RSV. WSB's Sabrina Cupid in Atlanta.
A CDC advisory panel voted to recommend a new RSV vaccine for all infants under 8 months old. It would need to be given as close to RSV season as possible, which is typically between October and March here in the United States. In clinical trials, this shot cut the risk that a baby would need to be hospitalized because of RSV by about 75%. It was 90% effective at preventing the need for intensive care for babies with RSV.
MIT researchers say they've developed a tool that could help detect breast cancer for higher-risk women.
It's a wearable ultrasound device that sits in the cups of a bra. It picks up early changes in breast tissue, which can result in a higher survival rate. MIT professor Janin Dattabaran was the lead researcher on the development team.
Based on our humble calculation, this technology has the potential to save 12 million lives per year globally.
She says she's preparing for clinical trials that she hopes will lead to FDA approval. She says the device could be deployed worldwide in 4 to 5 years. Christopher Cruz, CBS News.
Hyundai and Kia say owners of 92,000 vehicles should park them outside. WWJ's Jeff Gilbert.
The worry is an electric controller in an oil pump can catch fire. No real-world fires reported, but there have been 6 reports of melting components. The recall impacting a number of Kia and Hyundai products from the 23 and 24 model years.
A baby grand piano used to compose Queen's greatest hits and some 1,400 other items that belonged to the late Freddie Mercury are hitting the auction block. But before they go out to bid, the items, including handwritten draft of Bohemian Rhapsody, will go on display in a free exhibition at Sotheby's London. This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
I'm James.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
For WCFW and the Tap FM, I'm Jimmy Cuska. Here's what you need to know in the Chippewa Valley. The FBI has joined the search efforts for a missing teenager in Sauk County. 13-year-old James Yablonski left his family's home in June. The van he took, along with his cell phone, were found near Devil's Lake State Park. The Sauk County Sheriff's Office said that Yablonski had been searching for ways to travel out of state before going missing, according to evidence on several electronic devices. The boy's family is offering a cash reward for his return. Anyone with information should call 1-888-TIP-SAUK. Tuesday's drawing for a jackpot worth over $1 billion didn't have a jackpot winner, but somebody in northwestern Wisconsin became a millionaire. The Wisconsin Lottery said that a $1 million winning Mega Millions ticket was sold at the Quick Trip in Bloomer. The winning $1 million ticket was one of just 7 sold for Tuesday's drawing nationwide. The jackpot for Mega Millions grew to an estimated $1.25 billion with the next drawing tomorrow night. From the Civic Media News Desk in western Wisconsin, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
Have you Googled yourself lately? Are there negative posts from an ex-employee or from a former client? Maybe an outdated news article or sensitive personal information about your family? Search engines don't always get it right. But right or wrong, it's your reputation on the line. That's where Reputation Defender by Norton comes in. One of the most trusted names in online reputation repair. Reputation Defender has been fixing people's search results for over 15 years. Their cutting-edge approaches help you to wipe away unwanted information in your search results. They also promote the good stuff, so that it rises to the top, helping you put your best foot forward. Your good name is too valuable to leave to the whims of a Google algorithm. Take control with Reputation Defender. You can start by getting your free reputation report card at ReputationDefender.com. or call 800-401-6681 to speak to an expert. That's 800-401-6681.
Flowers, vegetables, and crab apples, some of the first Marathon County Fair attractions, and showed us proof those crops could grow there. Started in 1868 by the Agricultural Society, the Wisconsin Valley Fair in Wausau began as a place to buy and sell those types of goods. Today, it's considered one of the best in the state, featuring displays, demos, and big-name entertainment included with the price of your ticket. The Wisconsin Valley Fair runs August 1st. First to the 6th in Wausau. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app. Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
Website formerly known as Twitter, at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the other day I asked a simple question. I worked for a company for 20 years that on Monday went out of business. They shut the doors. In fact, there's a truck across the entrance of the place that I worked for a number of years. They laid off all the employees, all 30,000 nationwide. And I asked the simple question, how is it that Yellow Freight's stock was on January 27th, it was 49 cents. And the day they announced they're closing the doors and firing all the people and you know, I guess eventually going to liquidate, the stock price goes through the roof. And as I said, look, it's completely not how I believe the system was created or should work. But I said I was going to get somebody to explain it to me, and I have done just that. I've asked our good friend Morris Pearl to come give us some thoughts. He's the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Morris, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, it's great to be on your show, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So walk me through this. Explain to me how this is possible, and then we can talk about all the other stuff. I'm stuck on how is it possible that a company goes out of business, as we're filing bankruptcy, we fired all our employees, we've shut all the lights off, everything's dark, we're not picking up anything, we're done, and the stock price quadruples, you know, whatever five times is, in the aftermath. How is that possible?
Yeah, they went from shipping about a million less than truckload shipments a month to zero. But about 10% of their revenue, Rick, about 10% of their revenue came from this third-party logistics company they own called Yellow Logistics. That part is still going. And there's a couple of guys called MFN Partners, a hedge fund based in downtown Boston, that's buying the company up. They currently own over 42% of Yellow from a very low percentage a week or two ago. And I think what they're looking for is that third-party logistics company that's still running with non-union people running it, that does like making all the arrangements for people who want to send stuff from someplace to someplace else, like both the local and the long distance. I mean, I don't really know much about trucking and third-party logistics, but that's kind of what they're doing. And I think that company that has about $500 million a year in revenue, these hedge fund guys in Boston might think is worth $400 million, because that's about what the whole company is worth right now. And they're buying Yellow maybe to get that piece of it.
Interesting.
So, as much as I can figure out, this part's actually making money. And even at the current stock price of $4 or $5 a share, that means the whole company Yellow is worth about $200 million. So not very huge in the grand scheme of things. You know, they used to make $5 billion a year in actual shipping down to zero now.
Yeah. No, what Yellow figured out how to do. And look, I on Monday I talked about Yellow's history of everything that it touches, it kills. And this time it touched itself and ended up killing itself. But, you know, I said, look, they figured out how to take the number one company in the country back in 2005, which was Roadway Express, and number two company, which was Yellow Freight. They figured out how to take the number one and number two companies and then make them the number three company, which, again, that's the power of Bill Zollers and the management there, how you take one and two and make it three. I'm not sure how that works.
Well, I think they were trying to be the low-cost guy and compete on price, and that meant not investing, to make a profit, charging lower price than other guys, they had to pay less.
Yeah, well, what they were trying to do and what the argument was back when the buyout happened is they were going to make a super union company. They were going to take over what was left of the National Master Freight Agreement and have one behemoth. Because they were the number one and number two companies, and the government allowed it, which I think was stupid. But they were going to be this huge carrier, and they were going to be everything to everyone. And they thought that that was going to give them the ability to use those synergy words and getting rid of excess redundancies and those corporate speak, which meant, you know, gutting a number of workers and streamlining their system. And it just didn't work because some shippers hated Roadway and some shippers hated Yellow. So if you showed up with a tractor that said Roadway and a trailer that said Yellow, both companies told you to get out of there and they were looking for somebody else. They didn't think this through really well.
A lot of people just think short term and they don't think beyond, oh, can I borrow some money and load the company up with debt, withdraw some of the cash, and maybe it'll work. And it more often than not doesn't.
So what happens to all this debt? I mean, you're the Wall Street guy. The government's the Trump administration gave them $700 million that evidently, we the taxpayers have 30% stake. What happens when this bankruptcy happens? Who's going to get stiffed?
Well, currently, the whole companies, you can buy the entire company for about $400 million, even though they'd borrowed $700 million just a couple of years ago. And will they pay off the government? Probably not. I mean, I'm not a lawyer and bankruptcy expert, but I would not be counting on that money if I was a creditor.
Yeah, and this is why, again, I come back to, the good thing is that the company never held the pension. The workers' pensions, the union holds their pensions, so the guys will at least get their pensions, which wouldn't have tanked. Let me ask you that. In a bankruptcy scenario like this, had Yellow held the pension of these workers, would they get that?
Yeah, generally the pension funds are held, as the ERISA money is separate, is not used by creditors. And so that's generally protected, although don't quote me, I'm not an expert on this field of
No, it's just that I've seen so many times when a company goes belly up, everyone who had a pension there now looking to the PBGC to try and cobble together a retirement because the company screwed them out of that. And I guess, I don't actually 100% know, but it just seems, well, I've heard this story before.
Yes. Yeah. And then the multi-state fund is certainly debatable whether it has enough money or not to pay off their pensions, and maybe not. But it's just, people are looking for short term, all these Wall Street finance guys come in with, bright colored ties, and they think, we can bend the rules here and there and withdraw some money for ourselves, our management fees and stuff. And who knows whether 10 years from now there'll be enough money to pay the pensions of these guys driving the trucks. And it's like, it's just a form of greed of finance guys getting ahead of the workers and just thinking that's okay because it's legal.
Yeah.
And putting, the letter of the law and their ability to bend the rules. And they actually believe that that's a perfectly ethical, moral thing to do, They don't think about other people. And it's just sad that that's what's happening to our country,
No, what's sad is, you know, I go back to, you know, the whole greed is good idea, and this idea that, you know, there are all these gimmicks out there on how business should be done. And, you know, maybe it's because it's personal to me, and I actually worked for one of the companies that was involved in this. But they were a company, Roadway Express was a company, that when Galen Rausch founded the company, it was all about, they bought terminals, they bought their equipment, their tractors, their trailers. Now, granted, you know, they ran them into the ground. It was like, you know, when I buy a car, that thing, before I trade it in or get a new one, it's pretty much done. They did the same thing, but you knew that the company was solid. You knew that they were invested in it and the workers were invested in it. And then you had the yellow model where they leased all of their terminals. They leased all the equipment. They had no real stake, to use a Republican frame, no skin in the game. So it's not surprising to me that when Yellow bought Roadway up and then bought up all of the other carriers they bought up, that they just ended up selling stuff off, just, you know, basically selling the furniture to pay the mortgage.
And that's what happens when you, you know, go to business school. They'll tell you, oh, you run a capital light model, that Wall Street will be happier with that. You know, don't own restaurants, franchise them. Don't buy stuff, lease it. You know, and then you don't need as much money. That's what I used to be. I used to work for a company called Kidder Peabody and Company. And, you know, and then we were paid based on return on equity. And what was the solution to that? Have no equity, borrow more money. And then he had a great return on equity. Other people were taking the risk. And that's what, you know, all of America's figured out by now, is that, you know, no skin in the game means you get big returns when things work well. And sometimes they do. And sometimes they do for a few years. And sometimes they don't.
Yeah, no, it's sad stuff. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Morris Pearl. Morris is the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires. PatrioticMillionaires.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they do. I got to get your thought on this story, changing topics a little bit. Evidently, our credit rating has been downgraded, which, you know, I thought the economy was doing okay. I thought we were moving in a good direction. But this Fitch organization, they have downgraded us. From I guess the 3A to a 2A plus, I'm sure there's something there. But the reasons that they gave are interesting to me. They said that it's the deterioration of U.S. governance, as well as political polarization reflected partly by January 6th. And also, let's not forget all of the hostage situations of maybe we're going to pay our bills, maybe we're not. Maybe we'll crash the global economy, maybe we won't. Is this a big deal?
I don't think so. It doesn't really affect anything. It doesn't really affect the government's ability to deal with treasury bonds and notes and bills and things like that. So I'm not really worried about that in itself. I am worried about the underlying issue. What they're really saying, like, imagine by analogy, like if you had a credit card, and then you and your wife were on such bad terms that you couldn't even like have somebody bring the check to the post office box, because even though you had plenty of money you're checking out, you're just so discoordinated that you couldn't put the stamp on the envelope and everything to mail it in. And, you know, you ended up paying your bills the last minute. And that's kind of what Fitch is saying. It's like, you guys have the legal right to print money, so you can't really run out, but you have such discoordination between the different parts of the government, with the House and the Senate and the White House and the Treasury Department, all this, that we're just afraid you guys are just not going to pay, even though you can. And maybe they're right. You know, we came very close. You know, the fiscal year is going to end September 30th.
Yeah, September.
And who knows how they're going to get these guys to agree on a budget, you know, come October. And I don't know what's going to happen.
So this is kind of, do you see this as just kind of a, hey, we're watching? Because, you know, again, I don't know what all this means. I don't know if it's going to make, someone said it's going to make our debt more expensive. Does this raise the cost of our borrowing money? Does this in any way, you know, cost us more?
The Fed really determines what interest rates are. So no, this doesn't really affect interest rates. Nobody who's buying government bonds are like, oh, they used to be AAA Fitch, now they're AA+. A, they're different from Moody's and S&P anyway. Those are the bigger ones. And they didn't even agree on between themselves. I wouldn't worry about it as a thing unto itself, the AAA versus the AA plus, because investors consider U.S. Treasury in a separate category anyway. They're risk-free according to bank balance sheet regulations. So it doesn't even matter what the rating is. But yeah, I'd worry about the underlying issue that Fitch brought up, that our government is just not able to function properly because every time something needs to be done, a few Congress people or half of them or something can say, oh, I'm not going to agree to do this unless you agree to whatever it is I want to do. And that's a tough way to run a country.
It is most certainly a tough way to go run a country. Every time we get to one of these artificial debt limits, it's always another episode of 24, the ticking bomb. Will we destroy the global economy, or will someone find sanity?
And the next one is going to, the debt limit's going to run out again, like the week of the next presidential inauguration in January of 2025.
If only we had a functional government. But Morris, I appreciate the time as always. I appreciate you sharing some thoughts on the yellow situation. Got my question answered. Thanks so much.
Great to be in your show, Rick, and talk to you again soon.
Thanks so much, our good friend Morris Pearl. Make sure you check out their website, patrioticmillionaires.org. Quick break, right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here's some interesting little tidbits for all of you Amazon fans. Federal inspectors, again, found ergonomic hazards, inadequate medical care, and other health risks, health and safety risks at the Amazon facility in Logan Township, New Jersey. And now remember, understand, OSHA has enough manpower to inspect every workplace in this country in just a little under 190 years. Let that sink in for a second. So the fact that there's some inspections being done, we find some things going on. What they've found is that the workers at this Amazon fulfillment center were exposed to multiple ergonomic hazards, and they went through, you know, quite painstakingly the number of things. They've proposed, you know, almost $16,000 in penalties because, you know, the fines just way too expensive. And this is the part that I'm always amazed at. You look at some of the fines that OSHA can give because they cap this stuff, and it's like, well, of course there's going to be horrible, you know, things going on. Of course, no one is going to address, you know, ergonomic claims, health and safety claims, if the penalties aren't there. Now remember, we're told, you know, carrot and stick kind of thing. Amazon has been, research shown, the warehouse workers there are injured at a higher rate than other warehouse workers. And this is one of those things, because I actually worked for it was True Value Hardware Stores at the time. The company was Cotter and Company. They were the distributor for True Value Hardware Stores. And there was a union there. It was, you know, Teamsters. I was a member of Teamsters Local 293 in Cleveland. And we had committees, you know, this is going back in the 80s, for health and safety, that if something was not right, the union made sure it was done. This is, again, you know, my early years of seeing the companies and the unions butt heads was informative. That butting of the heads, you know what that did? That protected people. That made sure people didn't get hurt on the job. And I look at Amazon. I think about my time in that warehouse and all of the things that could have happened and all of the corners that could be cut. And all of the things that management really wanted to do, but couldn't, because there was a cop on the beat. There was a union steward there. You know, I tell the story all the time of one of the maintenance guys. He wasn't too bright. Nice guy, really nice guy, could fix anything, but was not very bright. Did exactly what he was told. And the manager at the time of the shop said, hey, you know, go take that 55-gallon drum of oil and just go dump it out in the back. And even he's questioning, is that smart? Now, understand, the guys in the shop were not unionized. So as he's driving the giant barrel of oil through the facility, the steward stops him and goes, hey, where are you going? And the guy goes, oh, I've been told I got to go dump this out in the back. And the steward almost lost his mind. If I remember right, actually took the guy's keys out of the tow motor and marched up to the terminal manager's office and said, you know, what the heck? Long story really, really short, that oil didn't get dumped out in the back. And you go, well, that's a good thing, right? It's an absolutely great thing. One, showed you had a little power in the workplace, but two, saved the environment a little bit, but three, saved the company from itself, because the company didn't even want to do that. It was this one manager who wanted to cut corners. And this is what we find in these warehouse settings. I talk to people who work in warehouses and freight all the time. You know, the things that they're subjected to wouldn't happen in a facility that had a union. And this is why I am such a supporter. Why I think it's important that everyone has that contract that lays out the conditions under which they can toil, and then gives them the ability to say no. I mean, there's nothing more powerful than being able to go, no, I'm not doing that. No, I'm not going to take this unsafe vehicle on the road. No, I'm not going to do this unsafe thing that's going to not just harm me, not just hurt my family, but hurt the company as well. Hurt you and hurt your profits and hurt the facility. This is the part that I think most people seem to forget, and why I believe, you know, every working person should be out there right now forming their union. What's coming is going to be catastrophic. When AI and robotics and all the automation hits, it's going to be catastrophic. It's going to be massive. And I look at the contracts that the Teamsters just negotiated with their freight division and with their package division. Both of them have language in there to protect workers from the future technologies. Have taken the cab facing cameras out. Have taken the surveillance out. This is important. These are important battles. And the longer this goes without anyone responding to it, the harder it's going to be to undo, which again is why I look at the writer's strike and the Screen Actors Guild who are on strike. They're fighting a battle much beyond wages and hours. They're fighting a battle for the future of their craft, for the future of human workers. We should be involved in that as well. I want to hear your thoughts. What are your conditions? And do you have the ability to say, I'm not going to do something that's wrong? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'll take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was the day that became known in California as the Wheatland Riot. The Industrial Workers of the World, or Wobblies, were trying to organize hop pickers who worked near the city of Wheatland in Northern California. Living conditions for the hop pickers were rough. Durst Ranch was the largest agricultural employer in the state, hiring hundreds of seasonal farm workers each summer. The Durst workers slept in tents. The bathrooms were latrine ditches dug into the ground. The well water they drank was contaminated and foul. The Northern California heat was excruciating, with temperatures soaring above 100 degrees. And while the temperatures were high, the wages were unbearably low. On this fateful day, thousands of workers gathered to hear IWW organizer Richard Ford talk about calling a strike. In response, the local sheriff formed a posse to arrest Ford. During the arrest, one of the posse shot his gun into the air to disperse the crowd. Chaos erupted. Gunfire was exchanged. Four people lay dead, including the district attorney, a deputy sheriff, a worker, and a young boy. Authorities blamed the IWW for the violence. Ford stood trial for causing the riot, even though he had fired no shots. Another Wobbly organizer, who was not even there that day, was also tried for the events at Wheatland. Both received sentences of life in prison for second-degree murder. Today, an historic marker commemorates the site. It explains that the event, quote, focused public opinion for the first time on the plight of California's agricultural laborers and resulted in new state legislation to regulate labor camp conditions. A new state commission on immigration and housing was created to improve working conditions. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Little known fact, a leading cause of death in Texas is Governor Greg Abbott. Yes, by intentional actions and deliberate inactions, Abbott has used his gubernatorial policies to kill thousands of Texans, including his calculated refusal to extend health care to millions of poor Texans, including nearly a million children, his intentional denial of water breaks for outdoor workers broiling under this year's 100-degree-plus heat dome, his lethal deregulation of utilities, causing the state power grid to collapse for days in the deep freeze of 2021 with hundreds dying for lack of heat and water, and his shameful prioritizing of gun extremism over the lives of schoolchildren. These people are not dying accidentally, but are victims of Abbott's premeditated policies and political ambition. Consider his silly scheme of throwing $9.5 billion of Texas taxpayers' money into the ditch of his highly ballyhooed border security PR show. Grandiosely branded Operation Lone Star, it has posed Generalissimo Abbott as a right-wing border hero. Some hero, he has stretched miles of razor wire underwater in the Rio Grande, slashing the flesh of migrant families and trapping babies and pregnant women in the coils. And Abbott's state troopers have been commanded to shove exhausted and injured refugees back into the river toward Mexico. As one appalled trooper says, we have stepped over a line into the inhumane. This willful cruelty is made ridiculous by the fact that Abbott's militaristic power play has totally failed to deter migration. After all, these families are fleeing for their lives and future, so he can wrap all of Texas in razor wire and they will still come and find a way in. This is Jim Hightower saying Abbott can kill lots of them, but he can't kill the human spirit.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show.
So if you haven't heard, breaking news. If you haven't heard, breaking news today. Breaking news. Donald Trump pled not guilty. And our quote of the day comes from Billy Barr, former attorney general, says, we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg on this. He said, I think there's a lot more to come, and I think they have a lot more evidence as to President Trump's state of mind. He knew exactly what he was doing. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the breaking news. I'll get some insight from maybe a little different perspective. I've asked our good friend Sherry Jacobus to come talk with us. Sherry is a political columnist and former RNC spokeswoman. Sherry, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So former RNC spokeswoman, I know the second that the Republicans nominated him, you head for the exit, but still,
yes.
You were on that side of the aisle. This has got to be at least a little difficult, no?
Oh, no. I mean, I got over any sort of, tugs at the heartstrings years ago after the Trump stuff. But, even though after he was nominated, I had friends that, in the establishment. They were not Trump supporters. The establishment GOP did not want him, but they all had to preserve their positions as cogs in the wheel. And so they went along with it. And they're like, but he's going to lose and we're all going to come back together. And I'm thinking, nope, I can never trust these people again. This was not about policy. I was always called a rhino anyway. Sometimes I agree with Republicans and sometimes I agree with Democrats. It's always been that way. But I no longer trusted them as people to be good stewards of our government and to even do the right thing. You can disagree on policy, but I always thought we always had the same ultimate goal in mind, both sides. So yeah. I knew something had changed. So I haven't been a Republican for since the summer of 2016. Was that 7 years now? Gosh. Yeah.
Wow. But here's the thing. Yeah. And it's interesting you bring this up because I ask the question all the time, which is worse, the true believer who wears the whole Trump outfit, or the person who's just in it because it's a gig and they know better, but they're doing it anyway. Which is worse. And
they're both horrible in two different ways. The people who are doing it as a gig. I mean, look, a lot of people who were on Fox News back during the primary and even when Trump was getting nominated, they would be sending me private messages about, they were not Trump people. They were alarmed. They were alarmed when their Fox News colleagues all of a sudden were jumping on the Trump bandwagon. And now they all are on board. And some of them who, if they had a contract at another network, they'd probably be anti-Trump, but because they're at Fox, they're pro-Trump. So I certainly understand when you work for the party and you're doing a campaign, you can't agree with your candidate on everything, but as a political operative, you're there to get them elected or do their will. If there's something egregious that they stand for that you can't do, well, you can't work for that person. But this goes way beyond that. And I think we are well past a point where there's any excuse for anybody who's in politics and knows about this stuff to be a Trump person and all of a sudden then stop because maybe it's better for their career to stop. And we've seen a lot of that. People leave the administration and they write books. So it's not been a good era at all for Republicans anyway. And former Republicans.
No, former Republicans, especially because I talked to my friend Joe Walsh, who I still can't believe I say that, because when Joe was in Congress, he was one of my favorite chew toys. But the fact is that we both agree on saving democracy. We may not agree on anything else, but what happened on January 6th was well beyond the pale. It's something that has to be prosecuted, has to be punished. So I got to get you. I got to ask you, what do you think of today's breaking news? He pled not guilty. And what do you think of the charges?
You see, I'm smiling ear to ear. So that tells you what I'm thinking about it. I was a victim of Trump's early on. I've been ringing the alarm about this guy for a long, long time. And some of us will never be made whole when what he did to us as individuals. But at least we're finally coming to our senses as a nation. I mentioned to you before we came on, there was a poll that I wanted to bring up because I think it's really interesting and it gives me hope. That is not something I say often in this era of Trump, but a Reuters poll that they did, that they did it right up until, I guess, Trump, for 2 days, right up until Trump showed up at the courthouse. And they were asking Republicans, if Trump is indicted, if he's convicted by a jury of his peers, would you vote for him? And 45% of Republicans said no. Then they were asked, if he were serving time in prison for his crimes, would you vote for him? And at that point, you had 52% of Republicans said no. This is why you have Fox News pulling their hair out, Jesse Waters out there. They have nowhere to go with this. So they have got to make it seem, they can't say he didn't do what he did. And right. You'd mentioned Bill Barr said there's a lot more to come out. Once people start hearing the real evidence, if they're allowed to, Fox won't tell them the evidence. But once they hear the nitty gritty details, I'm not saying that they're going to get all of these Trump supporters, but you only need a few of them. And I say this all the time, closer elections are won or lost in those margins. So the people that are not really the cult, the people who are not on Twitter, older, white, watch Fox News, maybe aren't online at all. They don't really have all of the information. We found that with the Mueller report, which is why I did my project, America Reads the Mueller Report, to try and reach those people who were not part of the cult, but simply didn't have the information because of Bill Barr. Remember, he lied.
Right.
So it's important to find other ways to reach these people with the information, because Fox News is not going to. I hope the trials are televised. They should be. But if they're not, there has to be a coordinated, simple, clear way to reach, not preaching to the choir, because we're all going to be glued to this stuff, but the people who need to hear it who otherwise will not. They only watch Fox News. You got to get to them another way. And that's where Democrats need to be spending their money and their resources.
Oh, boy, do they. Something I've been saying for, let me check the official watch, about 18 years now.
yeah.
just throwing that out. But you brought up the poll, and I saw that earlier. I saw it a little differently than you did. I saw it as, are you kidding me? 48% of people would vote for a Trump in jail? Are you kidding
me? Yeah, I know. But I look at it as a political strategist, like, okay, now we have the numbers. What do we do with them?
Right.
He can't win with, Trump can't win with that many people who won't vote for him. So look, Fox News and the people who are desperately trying to, hold on to their lives and livelihood by hanging on to Trump, they're going to do everything they can to shift those numbers too.
Yeah.
You can't deny that Trump did what he did, said what he did. He's on tape. They know that. So all they are saying is that it's not a crime. It's not a crime. And that's going to be harder for them to do. I think that even people who are still willing to vote for Trump just because he's got an R after his name, once they realize they may even decide for themselves, well, I don't care if it's a crime or not. He told us he didn't do it, or there's too much of this stuff, or that sounds kind of treasony once you get to the documents case. So Bill Barr is telling us there's a lot more. For the first time ever, I might take his word out.
We're in such a weird moment, Sherry. I mean, or at least I'm in such a weird moment, because generally I don't take anything Bill Barr says as anything that I would trust. I'm in this world where people that for years I always found as distasteful and distrustful are now, Mike Pence is now being viewed as some great hero because he did the basic duties of his job. I'm in this weird spot because now we have to give these people credit for at least in this moment not being entirely completely horrible.
Oh, we have to grade on a curve. I know. I don't look at them as heroes. I mean, Mike Pence is doing this strategically. He could have come forward 2 years ago or actually when it happened and said the same thing. Somebody, when I was talking about this on either Threads or Twitter, somebody else said, yeah, but keep in mind, he also, when he called the Trump lawyers, the cranks or whatever they were, he might be trying to lay the groundwork to kind of let Trump off the hook so that he can get some of these MAGA voters thinking Trump was out of the way anyway, but make MAGA happy by blaming the lawyers. You can say, well, Trump thought that there was all this fraud and he thought he could do this because he had all these lawyers who said he could. And remember, all of these lawyers are the ones that are,
Is that not going to be the defense,
though? Being indicted? Yeah. So, Pence might have been trying to help Trump with that, along those lines. But, you've got Mike Pence. He's not a hero to me. These people finally have to tell the truth because they have no choice. They're not heroes to me. A lot of these people that worked in the Trump administration and then leave and, they just didn't know, or they supported Trump until they didn't get the job they wanted, Solicitor General, whatever. And all of a sudden they don't support Trump anymore because they've seen the light. You know, Joe Walsh is one of the people who is legit in this stuff. I certainly am. You know, there's a lot of other people who are a little bit too late to the game, and they've done it to benefit themselves. Some now are doing it to keep out of prison themselves, to save their political careers. Other people did it before so they could get book deals and get on TV. And it's working for them. It's become very lucrative to switch sides and suddenly be against Trump. Like, oh, all that time I worked for him in a senior position in his administration, I just didn't know.
Yeah, all of them all of them will claim to be the secret leaker writing the articles.
And shame on the producers for putting them on the air, but you know, TV is still showbiz. So in some ways, some things haven't changed. I see too, the people who, the media and some people who claim to be quote fighting Trump, see air quotes here. It's very lucrative, and they were saying, well, DeSantis is more dangerous. It's like, no, he wasn't. DeSantis is Jeb Bush without the personality, without the exclamation point. Remember Jeb? But these people wanted Trump as the nominee because that's how they get their super PAC money. They make money, and media wanted him. This is just like 2015 and 2016. It's very dangerous. And I just read today that former President Barack Obama told Biden, expressed concern that, you know, Trump as the nominee is a lot more dangerous than people think, but we're doing the same thing. So people who say, well, we want Trump as the nominee because he's easiest to beat, it's like, yeah, I remember everybody saying that in 2015. He's not. DeSantis would have been, but people didn't want DeSantis because then they don't get the super PAC money so they can do the ads and they can't, you know, have all the clicks and they can't, I think cable news, you know, all wanted that too. I'm not being negative Nancy here. I'm just giving it to you straight I think people recognize this because we went through this before. And here we are in this place where, while I'm seeing the good in the poll because 52% who won't vote for Trump if he's in prison is, I guess, good. But to your earlier point, it's just really sad and disgusting that there are so many people who still would.
Yeah.
Many on our side are responsible for that, frankly.
The other side of this is, do you actually think he's going to be tried before the upcoming election? Do you think he's actually going to, we're going to get to a trial and do a sentencing to put him in jail? I don't think he's going to get the trial. I think they're going to be able to draw this out. You know, I'm no legal expert, but it seems to me there is enough ways to draw these things out that if he wants to, it's not going to happen until after the election.
I don't know. I hope that we at least get something. I think Jack Smith would like to move this along at a rapid clip after Merrick Garland dragged his feet, sat on his hands for a year too long or doing nothing. And that's again why we're in this situation. We've got to have this trial. We'd like to have the TV cameras in the courtroom. I don't know if we will. But this information does have to come out, and people do have to hear the evidence. I think that the reason that they did this as a standalone with Trump and didn't have all the other people indicted with him is because that would bog it down time-wise. They did it like this because it's cleaner, and they also didn't. Jack Smith also didn't go for. Seditious conspiracy and that sort of thing. He's going for the things that are cleaner and less cumbersome and that can get done quicker, you know, the obstruction, stuff like that. So there's some brilliance in that. It's unfortunate that Merrick Garland didn't have that same brilliance or didn't care to have it. Remember, a year ago this time, it was a January 6th committee who also got started kind of late. And Adam Schiff was warning Garland, say, don't wait for us, you go first. This is unprecedented that you wait for the committee to do it. And Merrick Garland didn't even know about Cassidy Hutchison. I mean, so thank goodness for the January 6th committee, you know, because we wouldn't be here. And also with the documents case down in Mar-a-Lago, remember, Merrick Garland actually dithered around and couldn't decide for a couple, you know, for several weeks. And we may never have even known about this. And we know that it's placed our national security at great risk. Remember how we found out that there was a raid? It was by Trump. Trump was still in control of the narrative. And people have to really appreciate that a little bit more and pay really close attention to how he is able to still control things, even though he's the guy who's indicted.
Oh, no, I've been saying this all along. Sure.
Yeah.
Been saying this all along. I mean, every time he's about to be indicted, he's saying, look, they're going to indict me and I'm doing this for you. I'm going to take this indictment for you because this is about you. I mean, he is a master at, look, I mean, he played the New York media for years as a real estate mogul. He knows how to play the narrative. He knows how to spin things. He's one of those guys who believes there's no such thing as bad press. And he's showing us that he can control the narrative and he's good at it. I mean, it's bad for democracy. It's bad for the country, but he's actually really good at it.
Yeah. Well, I remember when they were trying to get me to work for them, and Corey Lewandowski told me he was the first campaign manager for Trump, told me in like May, June of 2015 to try and entice me, you know, that he said that Trump has had Roger Ailes and Jeff Zucker in his back pocket. And of course, I didn't believe it at the time. Turns out it was true. You know, we had no idea, but he didn't just control the narrative and play the New York media all those decades. He also played law enforcement in New York and federal law enforcement let him get away. Well, federal law enforcement in New York, as well as state law enforcement, they let him get away with his stuff. He owned a lot of judges. He knows how to pay off lawyers. He knows how to control the legal system. And so far, it's still working for him because he's not behind bars and he is tied with President of the United States. He's tied with Joe Biden in the polls. This is nuts. So I'm glad about today. But we're still in pretty big danger with this guy. It was significant. And Barack Obama knows it, and he was telling Joe Biden. So maybe he should have gotten out there a little sooner and said it. I wish that Biden would, or Obama would have been more vocal and let people know that, you know, knock it off with this DeSantis is going to be more dangerous than Trump. And DeSantis is a really bad candidate. He's Scott Walker. He's Jeb without the exclamation point. You know, I'm waiting for the please clap line to come from him. So there are forces who pretend to be on our side who, in fact, wanted Trump, not really because they knew or cared if he was easier to beat, but this is how they make a lot of money.
It's the horse race. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. It's, you know, like, was it Les Moonves who said it? You know, it may not be good for the country, but it's good for the company. They're making tons of money.
Yeah. Good for CBS. Good for the media. Well, it's great for some of these super PACs out there. It's great. It's launched some media careers. It's selling books. And I remember saying this on CNN and got really attacked for it. It was like, I think it was towards the end of 2015 when we were all perplexed. Why were all these Fox News personalities jumping on this Trump bandwagon in a primary with 15 people in the primary? Certainly we expected Fox to go for whoever was the Republican nominee and the others would, you know, go for the Democrat. But it was so confusing to see this in a primary with this buffoon. And I said it on the air. I said, look, a lot of these people, they think that if Trump is the Republican nominee, they think it ensures that Hillary Clinton will win the White House. And a lot of these people made their fame and fortune the first time there was a Clinton in the White House, and they want that again. So it was that same dynamic. Now, those same people were able to turn it around and keep making money off Trump, and a whole lot of other people on the other side, you know, make a lot of money fighting Trump. So they need to have Trump as the guy to fight.
No, that is an excellent point. That is an excellent point. It really is about the money. But Sherry, I appreciate you taking time sharing some thoughts. And I wanted to share in your happiness on this day.
Yay.
Thanks so much.
And hopefully we'll have more in Georgia real soon.
We'll see. Sherry Jacobus, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much. As always, great stuff. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have a good time. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, The year was 1821. That was the day Uriah Smith Stevens was born near Cape May, New Jersey. Although he longed to be a Baptist minister, he worked as a tailor's apprentice and taught school. In 1845, he moved to Philadelphia. There, he became a member of the Garment Cutters Association in 1863, until it dissolved in 1869. From there, he joined several other garment cutters to form a new union. They called themselves the Knights of Labor. It was originally a secretive labor organization. Stevens' appreciation for religious ceremony infused the young union, which functioned like a fraternal order. Stevens took the title of first master workman of District Assembly 1 in the group. The organization would accept every worker, regardless of country of origin, race, religion, or trade affiliation. In fact, almost everyone was welcome to join, except for liquor dealers, lawyers, bankers, and professional gamblers. The Knights grew from just 9 members in 1869 to more than 9,000 by 1878. That year, Stevens became the Grand Master Workman, the top position in the organization. He soon resigned that position to become more involved in politics, but his organization continued to grow. It became the first national union to effectively organize across job types. In the 1880s, the union left behind its secrecy and became involved in the fight for the 8-hour workday. When the Haymarket tragedy occurred in Chicago, the Knights of Labor were caught up in the public backlash against organized labor. Although the group had no direct ties to Haymarket, its numbers plummeted. But the spirit of broad-scale worker organizing would live on in the United States, with organizing efforts such as the IWW and the CIO. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, Florida. I can't say Florida anymore without laughing. But, you know, here's the thing. It's nothing to laugh at. They're doing some not just crazy Florida man stuff anymore. They are leading the country, and let's figure out how to destroy education. In indoctrinating children. Now, remember, you know, you got the folks down there who are, you know, we're going to take on the woke agenda. And we're going to replace it. I don't even know what the woke agenda is, to be honest with you. But we're going to take it on, they say. I guess it woke is, what was their definition? You know, being aware that there are inequalities in society and wanting to do something about it. And if that's the definition, I'm on board with that. But here's the thing. The Department of Education there don't want to actually teach history. And we've talked about in the past some of the rewriting of some of, especially Black history. That they have done. Now we find out that the Florida Department of Education, they've gone right on ahead and approved a new educational series. This is one of those things that's almost, it's almost laughable. If you've ever seen the PragerU videos, you know, Dennis Prager, the right-wing mouthpiece, they do, and I gotta be honest, you gotta give the right credit. They do create content with the intent to indoctrinate, and not just children, their parents and their grandparents as well. But evidently, the Florida Department of Education has reviewed PragerU Kids and determined the material aligns to Florida's revised civics and government standards. They say PragerU is no different than many other resources which can be used as supplemental materials in Florida schools at district discretion. It goes on to say PragerU Kids did not submit a bid to be included in the 2023 instructional materials adaptation of social studies. The list of adapted materials is available on the instructional materials page on the department website. Now, for those of you who've seen Prager's song and dance, it's you know, they take a kernel, like all good propaganda, and then they go to the extreme. Say the same thing about Jordan Peterson or any of the other right-wing mouthpieces. They take a kernel that I agree with, and then they explode it into go, wow, how'd you go there? Same kind of thing here. You've got now a talk show host who is taking their beliefs and wanting them to be indoctrinated into the Florida school districts. And we're not going to call them.